Batman and Hawkman.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Batman and Hawkman, from The Brave and the Bold, number 164, cover dated July 1980. And Chris, we just had Hawkman on the show in the BAS bit, on the DC Comics Presents bit. So it's turning out to be a very Hawkman year or end of year. Is he just a perennial team up favorite or what? Is that...
I think so. I'm waiting for him to show up on Marvel Team Up or Marvel 2-in-1 now, because he is just a utility team up guy. And I think it's because he's a famous superhero that didn't have a title, but he was famous enough to always be a guest star.
Yeah, I think he had a backup at this point.
World's finest, yeah.
I mean, here we go again. Let's preface with a reason or reasons why we like the guest character. What's so great about Hawkman?
I probably met Hawkman in Super Friends number 7 when all the Justice League guest starred in the story that introduced the Wonder Twins in that comic. Or it could have been on the all-new Super Friends Hour where he and Hawk Girl were occasional team-up guests. I've always liked both of them, and I honestly miss this version that's in this story, the Silver Age Thanagarian space cops. The whole advanced alien who uses Earth weapons of the past has a really nice, cool hook, and he has a fantastic visual, which of course didn't change that much from the original Golden Age look. But to me, this is still his best look. This is the prime Hawkman. His superpowers figure was one of the best in the line, and that's saying something because that's a fantastic, beautiful line. And I followed the Hawks in JLA, the aforementioned World's Finest, the Shadow War of Hawkman miniseries, and then their ongoing series after that by that same team of Tony Isabella and Richard Howe. And, you know, I would say I am a casual Hawkman fan, and then, of course, we got into all the the continuity mess. And I like the Golden Age Hawkman as well, but I do miss the Silver Age Thanagarian Hawks.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think I said as much when I talked him up with Bass just a couple months ago. Well, speaking of Bass, the fact that he is on record for disliking Hawkman and my ability to troll him about it, like when I made him play Hawkman in the now classic live RPG session we played on the Hero Points podcast, that's just one more reason why I like him, and that's the one I'm going to state today.
Yeah, I like that. That was such a wonderful... His Hawkman was just a great... Was great fun to play along with in that one.
Yeah, we were doing Wahaha JLI type stuff, I think. So it worked well that the guy who hates Hawkman was playing Hawkman as some kind of meathead. So
yeah.
So you haven't seen that. It's on the Let's Roll feed right now as part of the Hero Points podcast. So people can check it out. Chris was playing Batman. What, many versions of Batman, if I remember?
Right. Yes. Every time it was different Batman. Yeah.
Well, happily, we don't need to cover Hawkman's publication history because actually, we have to go back to Scott X and I, who did it in episode 17 of this show. So let's skip right to the synopsis, shall we? It's called The Mystery of the Mobile Museum. It's written by J.M. DeMatteis with art by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
And Stephen Mitchell. Take it away, Batman.
It was a slow crime night in Gotham City, so I was transferring the Mysterious Ones, ancient eldritch statues unearthed in a recent archaeological dig, from Gotham's Metropolitan Museum to Midway City's museum. I asked Alfred to pull the Whirly Bat for me, but he instead prepped the Batcopter. He had worked so hard, I didn't have the heart to tell him of his mistake. As I arrived at the Midway City Museum, my fellow Justice Leaguer Hawkman helped unload the decoy crate from an armored truck. The ruse was to dissuade thieves from stealing the invaluable statues. Little did the guards know Hawkman was really museum co-director Carter Hall, and his wife Shiera, aka Hawk Girl, was supervising the transfer in her civilian disguise. I was about to set the Batcopter down and bring the exhibit through the roof when I was seized by immense pain. My mind was under siege from twisted visions of my friends and allies, and unearthly things I'd never seen before. When I came to, I realized I had fallen out of the Batcopter. I grabbed a flagpole to slow my descent and landed safely on the ground.
My Batcopter wasn't about to be so lucky, if not for the intervention of a certain winged wonder.
Confident that Batman is safe, Hawkman takes to the skies and brings the Batcopter gently down, saving the statues from assured shattering. But before he can ask about the psychic attack on Batman, the museum lifts off the ground, and inside, Shayera Hall is knocked unconscious by a free-floating hammer. As Batman rappels up into the building, Hawkman finds he can't follow. A force field has been thrown up.
Inside the Rising Museum, I watch Hawkman fly off, no doubt to retrieve a device from his ship to break through the force field. Lucky for Shayera, I keep two oxygen masks in my utility belt. I don one and place the other on her, wondering if the Mysterious One statues have something to do with all of this. As I reach for them, I'm attacked by two assailants in suits of armor from the museum. They don't put up much of a fight, and I am startled to find they are empty, with no one inside.
Hawkman returns from his spaceship with an oxygen mask of his own and an electromagnetic disruptor that makes short work of the force field. As a strange scream echoes through the museum, Hawkman cannot believe his eyes. Batman fighting priceless animated artifacts. He soon needs to smash an animated dinosaur skeleton while Batman fights a mummy, but these threats are clumsy and easily dispatched. What gives? But what the heroes don't see is Shayera slowly being possessed by forces unknown. She rises, and Hawkman is too worried about her to notice she's eerily glowing. She slaps him back, takes the Mysterious Ones, and flies out the door. Without wings. By this point, the museum is back on the ground, but Shayera most definitely is not. But why does Batman want Hawkman to let her go?
With the extra pair of wings Hawkman brought me, I try to reason with him, telling him he must let Shayera finish her task. When he won't listen, I'm forced to come to blows. Still, I try to tell him that the force controlling his wife isn't malevolent. It only seeks a host to finish its task. The longer we delay her, the more strain the force puts on her, which could result in her death. Hawkman damages my wings and leaves me grounded as he ignores my pleas.
Hawkman tries to grab Shayera, but she fights him like a wildcat, while simultaneously burning up with a fever. And then the deadly force inside her leaves, and Hawkman brings her and the statues back down. "You should have let me go," she says. Perhaps listening to Batman will yield more insight.
I explain that every time we neared the Mysterious Ones, the force field tried to repel us, but not lethally. In mid-explanation, I was interrupted by a telepathic voice, the sight of a glowing eye above the museum. This nameless entity was one of the Ma Prussia, from a world far away from our own. They worshipped the gods Myrrh and Wan, but eventually evolved past having corporeal forms, becoming beings of pure energy. The statues of Myrrh and Wan were swept up in a cosmic storm and accidentally deposited in a desert on Earth. Following them here, they needed a physical body to return them to their world. Contact with my mind led them to Shayera, who was more adaptable to the task thanks to the use of the Thanagarian Absorbiscon the Hawks used to learn about Earth customs. Hawkman and I volunteered to take on the entity's force together, and it sweeps us and the Mysterious Ones through the space portal toward their world. The experience is nearly all Hawkman and I can bear, but we finally arrive in the world of the Ma Prussia and return their sacred statues. Thankfully, they had technology which was able to transport us back to Earth to awaiting Shayera, who was happy to hear our mission was accomplished. Although she did wonder if the police will ever believe what actually happened to the Mysterious Ones. I can hardly believe it myself.
So you may have felt like this was very J.M. DeMatteis, even though it's 1980 and so pretty early in his career. I think the psychedelics call it out.
Yeah, the metaphysics and the psychedelics are definitely, yeah.
Before we get into this story, let's look at the cover as we usually do. It's by Jim Aparo to keep continuity with the rest of the series at this point, I think. But when you have JLGL interiors, I don't know, I think you sort of want a JLGL cover.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. I mean, as much as I love Jim Aparo, yeah, if you're paying JLGL, then pay him for the whole job, right?
Seems to me he's like a very good cover artist as well. In this case, I do like that. So what we do have on the cover is, I think the perspective is a little wonky, but the museum is, or all the terrain around the museum is floating up in the sky. You see the ground way below, and Batman and Hawkman are fighting these glowing knights. And I do like the knight is stepping on Batman's hand, and it's causing him pain and all this sort of business. I don't dislike it, but I don't know, the perspective wants everything to be in the image. And I don't think there's enough room for everything.
That'd be a hard assignment to. Okay, you need to show that the museum is floating through the air, but you also need to make sure the figures of Hawkman and Batman are big. That's the problem. And I do like that we see the, you know, the hole that was left from the museum. And if you look, I saw when I was looking this up online, the original artwork's out there as well. And you can see there's a little bit more of the buildings that are next to the museum. It's kind of, you just see one, the corner of one by Hawkman's foot on the printed comic, but he actually did draw more buildings. I mean, it's still weird that you can see the edge of the earth, like literally the the horizon of the
the curvature.
The curvature of the earth, yeah. So it's kind of strange, but it's a shorthand for, yeah, floating museums taking off, yeah. So
one bit of interest, I guess, to me is how the side of the museum is black with kind of like lines. Because of the positioning of the Batman logo, it looks like his body is down there, like his, because this is the logo with his head on it. And then because that's black underneath, it just looks like Batman is hiding behind his logo and that's his whole body there, his cape.
He's speaking above his name. I like that, yeah.
Right. So the story itself, what did you think of this one?
It's like you said, very J.M.D. Mateus. It's interesting. It's got a very Lovecraftian kind of feel to it, but you know, less horrific than, you know, Lovecraft usually is. But it's definitely got some of that in there. And it's enjoyable. It's a nice mix of, you know, we'll get into that as we discuss this as more of a Batman or a Hawkman story. But I think everybody gets plenty to do, including Shiera, who I like the fact that she's involved, even if she never becomes, she was Hawk Girl, not Hawk Woman at this point. She never becomes Hawk Girl.
She never puts on the costume, but of course she gets possessed. And so she gets a lot of the action as well. So that's, I also think that's cool. I mean, do we resent the fact that she's never in costume? With JLGL drawing her, I don't think we care.
No. And I like her outfit. I mean, it seems very 70s, but it's also kind of timeless, too. He was great at that. I mean, he was one of those guys, I think, that actually paid attention to what, you know, fashions were in style and put people in contemporary clothes in his comics, which, you know, some artists did, some didn't, you know, and I definitely think he was one to do that. And so she looks like she could be like one of Charlie's Angels, you know, or Linda Carter in her Diana Prince outfit here. You know, that's one of her 70s Diana Prince outfits or something.
I think some artists just stop at a certain point in terms of following fashions and car styles. And yeah. So that's why I think like the Tim Burton's Batman, or the follow-up for me, it was really a follow-up, the Flash TV series of the 90s. They went ahead and said, well, it's all periods mashed together and there's sort of a certain 1940s style or a 1950s or 60s style for the Flash. And it's just like, that's just how we remember them, even though it's like fashion's never moved on.
Yeah.
I think it's true of a lot of artists. A comic book universe, you know, it's, how can we explain that Batman saw, in reality, Batman saw every car style from, you know, from the 30s through to today.
Right.
Within his life. So, you know, it doesn't matter to me in comics, but you're right that JLGL was a cut above, and I think that's a fashion joke.
Yeah.
Now, regardless, he does make a mistake here, or maybe the script made a mistake afterwards. It's like whatever they're saying in the, you know, you had time to change the words after you saw the art, and they didn't do that. So there's, I think, a failure of the editing by Paul Levitz. I'm sorry, Paul. But they keep referring to, you made a joke of it in the synopsis, but they keep referring to the Batcopter as the Whirly Bat.
Yes.
It does seem to affect the plot, and it's certainly weird that Batman refers to it as the Whirly Bat when it is clearly not the Whirly Bat. It is a full helicopter. So
it is kind of strange. It's kind of weird that if he's got that large helicopter, why is the crate, this very valuable crate, on the outside of the helicopter at any point, really? You know, I mean, it's unnecessary. He's got plenty of room in that helicopter to store, you know, he could put it in the seat where Robin sits, if nothing else. You know, even if it was the 1966 Batcopter, the Bell, you know, it's simply the Bell helicopter with the cockpit, and that's it. But no, this looks like there's room for cargo and equipment behind it, you know. So this is around the time that the more modern Whirly Bats appeared in. I know they were in the Walt Simonson Calendar Man story around this time, you know. So, and they're supposed to be stored in the back of the Batmobile. They're the one, you know, the one-seater helicopter. This is the full Batcopter.
If it were the Whirly Bat, then you could imagine, okay, where the crate is dangling off the thing, but not here. So, you know, so that's a little mistake there, and it continues to haunt the story. But regardless, I want to take a minute to mention the opening prose, because I feel like maybe this is a little Easter egg. The mysterious ones, two eldritch statues unearthed by archaeologists in the scorching desert. They are the biggest thing to hit the world museum circuit since King Tut. And of course, King Tut was a villain on the Batman TV series who wouldn't be in comics until, I think they did a story eventually in the 90s, I think. But I wonder if that's supposed to be a wink and a nod to that.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah, it very well could be. I mean, they had to know anytime, because King Tut was actually a pretty big villain on the series that kept coming back, Victor Buono as King Tut. So yeah, everybody knew that. And I mean, in fact, around this time, they created Maxi Zeus for the comics, which was essentially a Greek version of King Tut. So yeah.
I don't think I ever made that connection, but it makes complete sense. And speaking of guest stars or Easter eggs, when Batman is hit with the psychic vision on page 2, we get a bunch. I don't know. Are we seeing, it's an assault on his mind. There's a Lovecraftian creature, or one of the statues, really. That's what they look like. But note also the weird eye underneath him, which we're going to see an eye motif when it comes to the entity later on. And then you have what his best friends. I mean, we recognize Robin, Superman, the Hawks, because they are in this issue. I didn't know they were that close. And then the other ones are a little harder to make out.
I think the one next to Robin is Batgirl, you know, Barbara Gordon. And then the woman, the woman next to Superman could be Wonder Woman, but I think it's Selina Kyle, because below Superman's chin, it looks like the Catwoman mask, the Catwoman cowl. And at this point, Bruce Wayne was dating Selina Kyle in Batman, written by Len Wein. Paul Levitz was trying to integrate continuity into every Bat title. He was dropping a lot of little bits of dialogue in Brave and the Bold about what was going on in Batman and Detective and things like that. So I think that's supposed to be Selina in between Superman and Batgirl.
And you would say that, like, she's taken off her mask and the mask is sort of next to her?
Yeah, I think that's because the thing at that time was she wasn't Catwoman. It was like, is she going to become Catwoman again? And then, spoiler warning for that arc, Catman shows up and starts committing cat crimes, and then she's getting blamed for it, and she has to get involved and become Catwoman again, and her and Batman fight Catman. So
okay, well, I'm convinced. You're the expert. You have a sort of photographic memory of this era of Batman, so I don't have a better theory anyway. On page 3, we have Batman jumping out of the, well, he fell out of the copter, but he bounces back. He immediately does some acrobatics, a little bit Daredevil there, and lands on his feet. And Hawkman, to save the statues, brings the copter down. I love these poses, by the way, but it's interesting because a couple of months ago, I was talking to Bass, and in that story, it was kind of absurd where Superman felt like, or said that the Thanagarian punches could bring the Eiffel Tower down. And then we thought that's a level of super strength that we've never seen. But here, I think it makes sense with, you know, the anti-gravity belt, that Hawkman can lift something. I think he has the powers for it, that he can punch something, you know, bring down a national monument. No, but this is done right.
Yeah, I totally buy this. I don't have any trouble with this because and when you guys covered that issue, I thought the same thing, and I think I even said something in the feedback about it. But yeah, I agree. This applies to what we in general accept that is the power range of Hawkman's anti-gravity, his nth metal belt. You're the role-playing guy. I don't know what Hawkman's stats say in the I've got the DC role-playing game, the original, and I've got several of the source books, so I could look it up. But I doubt it says that he's got the power to knock over the Eiffel Tower with a punch, you know? So.
Yeah, I don't know offhand. I think it's only just above human strength, which would still mean like double a human strength or five times the human strength. I don't think it goes much beyond that. Page 4 is when the museum lifts off the ground and things are also being very telekinetic, poltergeisty inside. Poor Shaira gets hit upside the head with a hammer, so it's not a... I don't know, for an entity that's going to turn out to be fairly benign, this is sort of violent and dangerous and lethal, maybe?
Yeah, there's been people obviously killed by hammer blows, so yeah, that's not, that's pretty, you know, it's not like he cracked a vase over her head, it's literally a hammer, you know, so.
Thanagarian skull, I mean, if Hawkman can bring down the Eiffel Tower, so can Hawk Girl.
Right.
But yeah, it's this whole business with lifting the museum up in the air, I mean, eventually, once they're done with the fighting inside, they're going to bring it back down? It's just going to be down again? Is it just a Hawkman motif that things have to go up into the sky?
I don't know. I was thinking, like, I was trying to, well, was the entity trying to bring the whole museum with the person they're trying to use? Is that what originally was their plan or something? I don't know. I really don't understand why the entity would make the whole museum start floating into the air other than it's a cool story hook and it makes for a cool, captivating cover.
Yeah, that's probably just it. the story demanded drama.
Yeah.
There is a bit here where Batman jumps into the museum before the force field closes up and Hawkman is stymied. And there's a strange... Especially today, the way that these characters are written. Hawkman's contention here is that Batman is impetuous and leaps in before making an adequate plan. So it really goes against the modern theory about Batman. Also, it comes from Hawkman, of all people, who then, you know, just after that, smashes headfirst into the force field. So be careful what you say there, glass houses. And because Hawkman has always been the more, I don't know, impetuous may be the wrong word, but definitely impulsive is what I want to say.
Yeah, it's strange because, you know, now we have Batman that plans that is already like 15 steps ahead of everybody. And Hawkman is this, they've leaned more into the savage side of Hawkman in a lot of ways, who is more just reactionary. So they've kind of switched roles, the modern version of these characters in a lot of ways, but I do like that, you know, Hawkman kind of being fussy and complaining. This is the same kind of tact that JMD Mateus will take when he's scripting Hawkman in his brief time in Justice League International. You know, Batman actually recruits him and Shaira into the new league, and he points out how positively grim he is, which, you know, Shaira thinks is a hoot because Batman's telling him he's being, you know, an old fuddy-dud and grim and quit being such a stick-in-the-mud K-tar. And that was Hawkman's role for the few issues that he was in it. So I kind of feel like this is a warm-up for that, because Hawkman does seem like he's a little bit put out for a Bronze Age DC hero in this one.
It's like a reversal. It's going to be like a full sequence of bunch of fights with... They're just making sure there's a lot of action in the story, because otherwise it's going to be very heady and mystical and bizarre. So here, this is the section for kids where we're going to have a lot of fighting. Hawkman does go back to his ship in orbit and so on, gets the device that can open up. But by that point, I mean, like, the museum is on outer space at that point. So maybe it's like the entity's trying to bring it closer to its own mind. Maybe it, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But regardless, we get plenty of floating objects, you know, empty knightly armors, fighting, dinosaur bones animated. So what do you think of all these fights? Are they entertaining enough?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think this, like you said, we've got to appeal to the kids, the newsstand readers. And, you know, I was one of them. I bought this off the newsstand. So either that or I got it in a Whitman 3-pack. I can't remember, but I had this issue as a kid. So, yeah, I mean, you've got to have, you can't just have some eyeball show up and talk for, you know, 17 pages. So, yeah, you've got to animate, you know, dinosaurs and knights and mummies. I mean, all the, you know, it's like Night at the Museum without Ben Stiller and with Batman and Hawkman in it, basically, at this point.
I've never seen it, but I thought the same thing. As far as dinosaurs go, it's there's look at those teeth on a herbivore. So it's really the bane of paleontology has always been the putting the wrong bones on the wrong creature. And that's how we got the Brontosaurus at some point. So this is similar. And you know, the buff mummy, and it's comic book archaeology. It's comic book museum.
You know, he's the hammer, Christopher Lee mummy, who was a pretty big guy, you know? So it's like maybe that's who it is.
And I want to give props to Batman. Regardless of what Hawkman says, Batman carries not one, two oxygen masks in his belt. So he's more prepared than Hawkman gives him credit for.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, this is a time when, yes, Dick's away at Hudson University, but, you know, Batman and Robin are, you know, still obviously the dynamic duo during this period. You know, I mean, they still team up from time to time. So that's probably just a leftover. That's kind of like, you know, when I was like a teenager, literally, we went somewhere with my mom and she's like, we had a mess and she's like, oh, I've got a washcloth in my purse. Because my mom, like when we were kids, like, you know, before you had wipes, the disposable wipes like everybody's got now, she would carry a damp washcloth in a like a Ziploc bag in her purse. And she pulled it out when I was a teenager. I'm like, Mom, why are you still carrying that? So Batman's still carrying Robin's oxygen mask in his utility belt, even though Dick's off at college.
Robin doesn't have his own utility belt?
He does, but, you know, in case they're trapped, he's got to save him. You know, how many times does Batman come out of the death trap first and have to save Robin, you know?
And could be another victim. Somebody else was there. Yeah.
Well, that's true, too.
And in this case, I mean, that's true here. Hawkman also has a breathing mask, and it fits his beak. It's kind of an odd. It's an alien one, but it's an odd shape.
Yeah, the two bubbles around the little points that come off his beak. That's what's really strange. It's like, couldn't it just like fit? Like, I know Hawkman's an alien, and it doesn't bother me. This does not. I don't like to see Superman in a spacesuit or a rebreather, but that's Superman. How does Hawkman survive shirtless in the vacuum of space? The cold. I mean, the cold alone would kill him. You know, I mean, yeah, it's like, he'd die of hypothermia instantly, right? Or
Thanagarian skin.
I thought a Garian skin, I guess, yeah.
We don't know. He's got more powers than people give him credit for.
That's true.
And in this case, last time we looked at Adam Strange, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Hawkman is also part of that tradition of the kind of rocket hero through Flash Gordon and those Hawks, you know, those winged characters. So this is the second time in a row for us, not in issue order, obviously. But for us, it's the second time that they get, you know, Batman gets, in this case, wings. He had a rocket pack in the last time we talked. So everybody wants a flying Batman.
If Mego had made a Hawkman figure back in the day, I know I would have taken the wings off of him and put it on my Batman to, you know, to duplicate this look from this comic. I know I would have, because I did other things like that, you know. So yeah, it's cool. It's a cool visual to see. And I remember there's you guys will probably get to it eventually, that DC Comics Presents, where Superman is flying toward the camera with Hawkman wings on, and Hawkman is holding Shiera as Hawkgirl, who's like passed out or something. I think it's an Alex Saviak cover. I can see it in my mind. So it's like, there's something about seeing the other guys wearing Hawkman's wings, which is just cool. You know,
I know the one you mean, but since we just had a Hawkman team up, this is going to be years from now.
Right. Yeah.
At the speed the podcast flies. but yes, it's a cool sequence. JLGL, of course, draws the hell out of it. Batman is a very quick learner, but Hawkeye downs him rather quickly, as he should. He knows this apparatus.
I like that Batman is not able to, you know, Batman gets a punch in the solar plexus, but then Hawkman knows where to damage the wings, and Batman's molting, basically, as he's plummeting toward the Earth.
And so Hawkman gets to his wife. She is flying around with those statues. She elbows him in the face, you know, but then the entity leaves her. Like, this hasn't worked. And Batman is going to give us the big info dump. I mean, you had to synopsize this, but the entity is going to show up and we're going to get into the psychedelics. What do you think of this whole Cthulhu premise all of a sudden.
I like the fact that the aliens really are benign. That's a nice touch. There is really no malevolence here. There's not even a, whether they're a little malevolent, but they're not so bad. It's like, no, they literally worship these gods and they had these statues, and it just so happened that this cosmic storm sucked them away, as like all good Star Trek aliens, they left their corporeal form at some point, you know, because that's what happens, you know. Advanced alien races become...
It's very Star Trek.
It's very Star Trek, and then you've got to, you know, take possession of Kirk, Spock, and Deanna Muldaur. So, you know, that's...
Man, I thought the same thing. My children.
Right. Yeah.
Sargon. I thought the exact same thing. Look, Hawkman, risk is our business.
That's right. And,
they even use the term mind meld.
Yes.
So Jem DeMatteis, obviously a fan.
It's definitely Star Trek beats Lovecraft. Yeah.
The heroes are let themselves be possessed together, so that like the entity is too strong and you really can't do anything with just one person, and Shaiir is maxed out, taxed out. Suddenly it turns into like a spirograph project. They get thrown into the wormhole, and, you know, like page 16, I'm going to put page 16 for sure in the gallery post, because it's wacky.
Yeah, I mean, this would make one hell of a blacklight poster, wouldn't it? I mean, the Marvel blacklight posters from early 70s, yeah, this would... And in fact, that panel of the very strange-looking Batman screaming and Hawkman doesn't look as weird as Batman. I mean, Batman almost looks like the demonic bat that the Scarecrow saw in Batman Begins when he was freaking out on his own drugs. He kind of looks like that. This panel and the panel where Batman's falling into the, on page 2 with Robin, Batgirl, and Superman, all that, they both lived rent-free in my brain ever since I bought this comic, so...
Wow. And eventually, I mean, they delivered the statues. We see all the entities are all in these glowing balls with an eye in it. Then we're told, bam, they just teleport back home. Apparently, these entities had incredible teleporters. They're still around. You know, maybe you can fix one up or something. Maybe one of them still works. This is it. This is the last page. We got to get back home. We cover this really quickly. Because it's not the story, right?
Right. We've got a nemesis backup we've got to get to, right? Or something, right?
Not even, I don't think. Not in this issue, right?
But no, anyway. Not this issue. I'm kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. They get back home. Shaiira's there with the cops. It's like, how are we going to explain the valuable artifacts have disappeared? Ha 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 ha. Just like a Star Trek episode. Laugh it up. Well, we'll talk about this ending when we do our little feature there, but not about anything here, but there are, for me, I've got the comic in front of me, which has all the ads, of course, and there are not one, but two O.J. Simpson ads in this book, one for boots and one for track shoes, yeah. And I will say these ads definitely don't have the juice anymore.
No, it's the dingo boots, is that what the boots, I remember though, yeah, I didn't get my physical issue out. I cheated and looked in my Batman by JLGL collection, and then the DC Universe Infinite app. I didn't get the comic out, but yeah, that's the Dingo Boots ads, and I know the two ads. I can see them right now that you're talking about. Yeah.
But I mean, it's great for ads. We don't talk about ads on this show. We leave that to Paul Keen.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really cool house ads. It's a great era for house ads.
Oh yeah, they're great.
All right, well, let's do those features, our mini debate. And we start with the question, how well does this fit each of the characters' stories or atmospheres? Is this a Batman story, Chris, or is it more of a Hawkman story, seeing that it takes place in Midway at Hawkman's Museum?
I think this is primarily a Hawkman story. It could be rewritten to just be a Hawkman story, honestly. I mean, I think you could take Batman out of it and... it would still work, and then like Hawkman and Shaiira could go together and take it back after Shaiira convinces him, no, I can take it again. You know, I can stand it, Carter, if you do it with me. And then they go off and do it. You know, so it could be a Hawkman story.
No, I agree. just Hawkman would be fighting all of these menaces alone at the beginning while she gets taken over. Yeah, you're absolutely right. A question we only ask in the Brave and the Bold segment is, do they know Batman's secret identity? You're the expert.
Well, at this point, I think all the Justice League know each other's secret identities. I think even Firestorm, which, you know, it's like they just let that kid in and then they tell him their secret identities. I don't know about that. But yes, definitely Carter and Shira know Bruce Wayne is Batman and vice versa.
Certainly vice versa. Like, Batman knows that Shira is Hawk Girl, right? This issue. All right. What about cool moves? What is Batman's coolest move?
I think just deducing what the entity's real intentions were while Katar was foaming at the mouth, you know, that was all upsetting. You know, he wasn't quite that bad, but he, you know, he was just, I understand if my wife was in danger, I'd be more concerned about all that too than like really paying attention to clues. And Batman is the detective, so
this is the moment where he's exactly what he's saying that Batman is, taking off without a plan.
Right.
For me, I went more physical, more you know, looking at the action, and I think page 7, the fight with the knights is, it's all great, but Batman throwing one animated knight's armor into the other is probably the big moment of that fight. So I'm gonna nominate that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What about Hawkman's?
I think, you know, he disables Batman's wings. That's a nice touch. I mean, Batman does get like a sucker punch in on him, but then he's just like, I know where to take these things apart. He like hits him one time in the wings, and then Batman's basically spiraling toward the ground. He can't fly up anymore. So yeah, that was a cool move.
He knows what feathers to rip out.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that rescuing the helicopter looks really boss. Just the posing and, the, you know, like bringing it down. Mm-hmm. It's a feat of strength from Hawkman that I like. Dumb or weird moves. What do you think for Batman?
I think him even thinking he can outfly Hawkman even for a second with his own wings. I know he adapts quickly, and he did. He can fly, but it's like, don't pick a fight with the guy that's like the winged Avenger or the winged warrior, you know, whatever. Don't tug on Superman's cape and don't pull on Hawkman's feathers, you know, basically. So
yeah, that's his thing. All right. Well, I think no big mistakes from Batman, I don't think. But JLGL drawing the Batcopter when the Whirly Bat is indicated, that's a miss. It's at least weird.
It is weird. Yeah, and like you said, why didn't they just change the script to match the art?
As far as Hawkman goes, I'm going to say that claiming the whole thing about claiming that Batman is impulsive, then refusing to listen to him, you know, just the opposite of what you were saying about earlier, is going to be the weak point for Hawkman. Just brawling with his friend to the point where Batman might end up falling to his death and just glides down. But Hawkman doesn't know this necessarily.
Yeah, and this is before Batman had a grapple gun. So, yeah, he could have died. Yeah, I agree. This is the big dumb move for Hawkman.
This is where he fails the trolley problem. So, the friendly farewell. In this case, not a goodbye per se, but Shira does run up to him so he can explain things to the cops. Hawkman seems stuck in his reverie after taking all those peyote buttons in the earlier pages. It feels like these guys are friends, and it's been established that they're friends and they're having a light moment.
You know, I always got that, you know, Batman and Hawkman always seemed to get along pretty well in Shire in the satellite era satellite eras particularly. So, and Shire is touching Batman's arm. All the heroes' ladies like to paw on Batman. It's because he's the hairy-chested Bronze Age love god Batman, as Grant Morrison put it. That's why, you know. So
I guess that was a thing, right? It's when Damian was conceived.
Right. Yeah.
Final question. If this were your first Hawkman story, would you seek out more?
Yeah, I think I would. The visual is just so striking, and you have the museum angle here and the alien technology with the ship and the star-shaped disruptor device, which I thought was cool. You get all the ancient, you know, artifacts in the museum. So you've really got a good sampling of what a Hawkman story could be like. So I definitely, you know, go find World's Finest and start buying it just for Hawkman, I think, from this.
You make a good point. They're really bringing in all the little features. You see the ship. You see, like, things that aren't necessarily important to this story are still featured so that you get a sense of what Hawkman comics are like. That's a good point. All right, we'll take a break for a couple promos, and then we'll be back with our special features.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, Kendra Richards takes flight this month as the new Angel Hawk, or at least her soul does. It's the sleeper hit of the winter as one young woman dreams of being an invisible superhero, and those dreams come true so long as no one wakes her. The new JL Avengers guest star. What is Kendra's connection to Hawk Angel? You need to read it to find out. Until then, make ours Amalgam. All right, we're back, and our monthly feature is the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Hawkman team-up. What do you got?
I've got Hawkman and Indiana Jones. The Hawks in the 60s could look for research help and reach out to Dr. Jones, then team with Indy and Marion post-Dial of Destiny on some quest for an archaeological MacGuffin. Indy would have a hard time believing the Hawks' alien origins, not wanting to acknowledge Kingdom of the Crystal Skull like most fans, and then Marion and Shiera would go off on a side quest of their own and find the MacGuffin first while the two men squabble.
I never thought of it. The archaeology angle, obviously, this makes a lot of sense. And you've got two couples if you take them at that point in their lives. So, yeah, love it. I have Hawkman and Hawkwoman team up with Hawk and Dove. And that would be the second Dove, so this could be a double date. So you have an aerial team and a ground team on the same mission against renegade Thanagarians who worship the Lords of Order or something. I don't know what Hawk and Dove do. You know, Hawk and Dove have contrasting attitudes, but I think we could say the same about Mr. and Mrs. Hawkman. So my team up explores that idea. And who knows, maybe Hawkman turns out to be Monarch after this.
It would have made more sense for Hawkman to be Monarch than Hank Hall to be Monarch, that's for sure.
I don't want to spoil the DC KO, but the Superman versus Captain Atom fight does point to Captain Atom being able to be Monarch. I think Josh Williamson wrote that, and so he agrees with us here.
Okay. So who's brave and bold next? This might be an indexing show, but it's going to jump around as inspired by the issue we're looking at now. So every episode will explain the thematic logic between this episode's guest star and the next. So Siskoid, where to now and how do you get us there?
Well, a winged character begets a winged character. I've chosen a team up with Man-Bat. And I know if we look at the last page here, the very next issue of this series is Man-Bat. But I'm going for an earlier issue in the timeline, which is Brave and the Bold number 119.
Nice.
I'm pretty sure you have it committed to memory already. You know exactly which one I'm talking about more than I do.
Yeah, I do know which one you're talking about. Yeah, yeah. And I think our buddy Sean M. Meyer's ears just perked up like Man-Bat.
Okay, now it's time for feedback on our previous episode together in which we covered Brave and the Bold number 190, starring Batman and Adam Strange. Let me start with Bucky749's comment. He says, let's do a real mystery Saturday morning style adventure. Adam Strange meets the Clue Club. Adam is at a family gathering when he catches the next Zeta Beam, being followed by his nieces, Dottie and Pepper, and their friends. I have no idea what this is, but I'm sure it means something to somebody.
Clue Club was one of the many knockoffs of Scooby-Doo that Hanna-Barbera created themselves. They basically just kept like running Scooby-Doo through the Xerox machine, and the copy just kept getting more faded and faded and faded from the original. So,
because I remember the girls with the kids with Captain Caveman.
Oh, the Teen Angels.
So I remember those. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that one. Yeah, that was good. One. Yeah. Rob Kelly from this very network writes in to say, my affection for Adam Strange started with his appearance on my beloved video comic show on Nickelodeon. I had seen some of his appearances in JLA, but these were probably my first time seeing him as a solo star. Infantino was at the top of his game then, and the gleaming surfaces of Ron looked amazing on my television screen. So while I haven't read Adam Strange comic in decades, I still have a warm place in my heart for him. Yeah, I really hope one day that those video comics episodes surface somewhere for Rob, because I'd like to see him myself, because the few I've seen, it's really cool, and I really kick myself for getting Nickelodeon after they stopped airing those.
You couldn't have known. Then Nate the Great says that apparel cover is a classic, and getting Infantino on the inside was a little like getting a bacon cheeseburger with only one piece of bacon. I'm also glad I'm not the only one who thought Adam Strange burned his butt with that jetpack. As for team-ups, Scooby-Doo and his gang could have found Adam faster. So here's another Clue Club reference in a way.
Right. Martin Gray writes in to say, was this the first time we heard Adam Strange came from money? I thought he was just an archaeologist with tenure. It's surprising Alana and Sardath wouldn't know enough about the qualities of the Zeta Beam and needed Batman to work things out. All good points, Martin. I don't know if somebody that's more of an Adam Strange fan, let us know. Was it established before that he came from money? I don't know. I would think Mike W. Barr, because he brought back such an obscure fact that the whole story hinged on, I'm guessing he got that from an old mystery in space story, but he might have made it up. Who knows?
I think it would make sense if, you know, how Adam Strange has to, like, go all over the world to catch the next Zeta Beam. That costs money. Maybe they explained it away, you know, by just saying that an inheritance or something. I don't know. Doug Adamson says, thanks for covering the book. I have to admit, I've not read as much Riven the Bold as I would have liked to. And of course, as pointed out, they are either missing or hidden away on the DC Infinite app. I often forget how impactful Infantino was to DC art. And while I would normally want Aparo's art over Infantino, I think DC did the right thing to give Carmine this book. After all, he was not only one of Adam Strange's main artists, he put the yellow oval on Batman. So it felt fitting. Sure.
That's true.
Of course.
Yeah. Paul Keehan from this network as well, on DC Special Cast, writes in to say, not Mike W. Barr's best work, as you said, given his predilection for Fair Play Mysteries and the number of other great Batman stories he has written. The reboot after Zeta Beam thing was particularly egregious. He might have been going for wacky Silver Age, but it didn't work. Yeah, it really didn't.
Okay. We get all opinions. Tim Price says, thank you guys for the pro tip on how to read this issue. I keep forgetting about the collections on DCUI Ultra, as I spend so much time reading individual issues, of course. But I did read its collection of Richard Dragon, partly for podcast research and partly for the time capsule of his stories, so that was fun. But it boggles my mind and offends me as a computer programmer to have the data for those issues available and not listing them as single issues. It smacks of laziness, which I do not accept in my profession. But then I realize it's a business decision to get the non-Ultra subscribers another reason to upgrade, and now I'm offended by the greediness. I think it's just greed, Tim. Don't need to innocent it. And there's some sort of scream that I can't read. Then he says, for the story, I totally agree. This is not a good example of Barr's work. The plot holes and existential questions stifle the whole thing. Its plus is seeing Batman play space hero, which I did enjoy having read Batman 30s through the 70s. Now, when I look at the story, it doesn't state precisely how Adam's letter got from the lawyer to Bruce Wayne. We just see Alfred carrying it in. Maybe Batman has his own P.O. box, preferably red and flashing when it has mail. Yeah, it makes sense. You know, it probably doesn't go to Bruce Wayne. It just goes to, you know, Bat Central or something. Sure.
I like to think that when Batman gets mail in his P.O. box, it's like the scene in Batman Returns where all the lights, the bat signals turn into Bruce Wayne's study and Michael Keaton stands up. That's what I want it to be every time he gets mail.
Okay.
But speaking of the DCUI thing, this issue is also another one of those that is on DCU Universe Infinite Ultra under the Legend of the Dark Knight by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez volume, praise be his name, volume, and not underneath its individual issue. So if you have DC Universe Ultra, you can read along with us. Just look for that collection.
Jeez.
Yeah. Okay. It keeps happening. Bill Cole writes in and says, the long ears on Batman ruined the artwork for me. Infantino should have done the cowl in his 60s style. Well, I think at the time they were like, I don't know. They just seem like, you know, Batman has long ears. So everybody draw Batman with long ears. They kind of tried to stick to a house design for Batman at the time. Nowadays, they let them kind of artists be more interpretive with how they want to draw Batman. But at the time, they probably were like, even if he drew them short, somebody, the inker would have, or somebody would have in the bullpen would have lengthened them and made them match the other comics probably.
Mm, yeah. I know it was an issue after the Batman movie that the length was very calculated. Mm-hmm. But at this point, consistency, I suppose. Ryan Daly, who will be my co-host next month, says, since you repeatedly brought up Adam and Alana's sex life, I feel compelled to mention that Tom King and Doc Shaner gave us the much-needed strange sex scene in their Strange Adventures comic. It was in issue 5, in case someone wants to skip to that part without reading the whole thing. No comment.
There you go. Gothos Mansion writes in, maybe my memory is playing tricks on me, but in all three of the Batman, Adam Strange, Brave and the Bold issues, Batman and Adam hardly spent any time together. I didn't realize it at the time this issue was released, because in 1982 I didn't have a back issue collection. A different artist on the cover and interiors was practically a tradition in the early days of the Batman team-ups in Brave and the Bold. Neil Adams stayed on the covers after he departed the interiors. Even one of the issues with Neil Adams' interiors had an Irv Novik cover. Yeah, the Teen Titans one he's talking about. Adams was still doing covers when Nick Carty did interiors, and then Carty stayed on covers while Aparo first started on B&B's interiors. No complaints from me. Those are all artists that I enjoy. Yeah, that's true. I mean, we talk about that. Gothos is kind of calling us out on what we said in this issue. Jim Aparo did the cover, JL Giles on the inside, but that was pretty common. So,
And it's an embarrassment of riches in a way. You know, if you like both artists, you get both takes. So it's not a major complaint. Oh, well, that's the bottom of the mailbag. So thanks for teaming up with me, Chris. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Well, I'm taking a bit of a producer break for a bit. I still have to do a wrap-up episode of JLUcast with Cindy, wrapping up the whole thing, but that will just have to wait until the first of the coming year because, you know, life, holidays, other podcast commitments. But you can catch me every month on Batman Nightcast, where I'm Robin to Ryan Daly's Batman. And no, I'm not shaving my legs.
Okay. Nobody asked. A reminder that we do have a Patreon. So if you like this content and want more like it, please think about making a monthly or a one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. And we do enjoy reading your thoughts, and the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll read your comments on this issue when Chris is back with us, but next month, I'll be here with our friend Ryan Daly as we continue his coverage of Marvel 2-in-1 with issue 32 of that title, I believe. On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.